Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. When a loved one goes missing, our first instinct is to call the police. We expect officers fanning out in search teams, detectives poring over evidence, Amber Alerts flashing across highways. We expect a response. But for thousands of families across Ohio, those images aren't reality. An investigation by the Columbus Dispatch has exposed systemic failures in how law enforcement handles missing persons. From overlooked evidence to overworked detectives and biases within the system, All Sides is dedicating this hour to those who have vanished. Columbus Dispatch reporters Max Philby and Danae King spent 8 months reporting out this story, and they join us now. Max, Danae, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
This series of articles is well-researched and well-reported, so first, kudos on a job very well done.
Thank you.
I have to ask, what got you interested in spending 8 months poring over all the missing people in Ohio?
So I think we both kind of have some different answers to this. I know, Danae, you have kind of a more personal story, but, you know, we had a new editor start in January at the Dispatch, and he really challenged us to find some sort of story or topic that would have a considerable and immediate impact on readers. And so Danae and I kind of took that challenge up and kind of ended up settling on missing persons because there are so many people affected by it. There is a ton of public data, and there are systems and agencies in place that could be held accountable or where reform could happen.
Yeah, and we found, like, this is something people want to talk about. Like, families of missing people, like, they feel forgotten in a lot of instances. Like, they want to talk about their loved one. They want this kind of attention. And really, we really felt passionate about telling their stories.
So how many people are missing in Ohio on any given day?
Any given day, you know, it's a range, but we kind of found roughly 1,000 or so. You know, that obviously fluctuates from hour to hour, if not day to day. But yeah, I believe last year it was over 22,000 Ohioans were reported missing total in 2023. And that's up actually about 18% over the last 3 years. But any given day, roughly 1,000.
And what kind of people disappear, Danae? Do they have mental health problems, abusive relationships, addictions?
Yeah, so it's kind of all of the above. Some people have none of those things, you know, are just regular everyday people. But we did find that there's people who suffer from addiction, mental health issues, who are kind of more likely maybe to vanish and more likely to be dismissed by police sometimes when they do vanish. We also found that it's very divvied up by race. So Black people are much more likely to go missing. They're 54% of the children who are missing in Ohio are Black, but only, you know, 13% of the population is.
And that kind of factors into my next question, Max, which is this all addictions, mental health, potentially race, relationships, that all factors into whether police prioritize their case, whether it gets that big, splashy, like the dogs and the police headed into the woods type thing.
Right, exactly. That thing you might see in like movies or on TV, that doesn't happen all the time. And in fact, the majority of the time, it probably doesn't happen. You know, the way police get so many cases a year, Columbus police themselves get thousands of cases per year. They have just 8 detectives investigating this, so they have to prioritize things. One way they do that is by age. The cutoff for what's considered a high-risk case, where they can sort of drop everything, give it their full attention, that age is 10 years old. So if you're 11 and older, you know, you're ruled out there. Now, there are, of course, other circumstances if they believe foul play is involved, if you're suffering from a mental health crisis, perhaps, or other things. Those all come into play as well.
Yeah, I want you to, I'm hoping you can tell me about Amina Alhaj Omar and her sisters who really broke the case looking for her.
Yeah, so that was one of the cases that really first got me interested in this. So last summer, we were down a position at the Dispatch, and I covered night cops for a week. So I was, you know, covering the scanner, and it was in June when Amina went missing. And so I was the one who got to sit down with her sisters, Miriam and Zainab, and really talk to them about what was going on. And so I remember being shocked at that point at like all of the things that they had to do and how much police work and investigating they were doing. And so, like you said, Anna, they really were the reason she ended up being found, unfortunately, deceased a month later. They told police that she was missing and, as her sister put it, were told, no, your sister's not mentally ill. And it's like, well, no, you know, she was diagnosed a few years ago. We know she is. We believe she could be endangered. And police kind of wrote her sister off. So her sister took it into her own hands and really became her own detective. And she got a locksmith to open her apartment and, you know, drove around the highways looking for her sister's car and ended up finding some footage that made the police kind of pay attention of her walking around in a gas station, you know, looking really scared.
Yeah. They asked, what I find fascinating about it is she goes missing. She's an adult. So they're like, look, adults can disappear if they want to. And then they don't take that. They essentially break into their sister's apartment. It's a mess. All the electronics are unplugged. She struggled with schizophrenia, right?
Yes.
And so they're like, okay, this is not good. But even after that, with the messy apartment and the missing sister, they have to find a gas station manager who shows them video of Amina wandering the store with a knife before they realize, oh, this is a real problem.
Yeah, it wasn't until they saw that evidence. So Miriam, her oldest sister, Amina's oldest sister, was working with police. She was like, please help me. And she just called and called and called. She was like, I know I'm annoying them. But it ended up that they gave her places where they had seen Amina's car. And so she followed that and found the gas station. And you're right, it wasn't until she got footage, CCTV footage, that the cops really paid attention.
And you know, Max, sometimes CCTV footage gets written over after a couple of days or a couple of weeks for sure. They don't hold that stuff in perpetuity. It's just too much data.
Right. And we found that to be the case in a lot of these investigations. You know, families might say, well, I knew my missing loved one was at Walmart, or I knew my missing loved one was at Easton, you know, was another case. But in several of these cases, police, for whatever reason, didn't get a hold of security camera footage, and evidence was lost to time.
So I want to talk about the scope of the problem. So nationally, about 70% of missing person cases are solved within 72 hours, according to the FBI. The Columbus Division of Police says it has a 96% recovery rate for disappearances, but Danae, Amina's case is counted as a recovery, right?
Yes, even though she was found dead a month after she went missing. So they count recoveries, not necessarily everyone who's alive when they're recovered.
So that 96% rate, it doesn't mean everybody went back to their family.
Right.
What did the Columbus Police Department have to say about Amina's case?
Yeah, so they said that they dropped everything, you know, and really focused on this, which they did after they saw the footage of her. And then they really, after that, wouldn't comment specifically on any cases. You know, we talked to several families who were frustrated with the amount of information they were getting from police, which was very little. And police said, you know, they kind of threw that back on the families and said they don't communicate among one another. So, but to answer that, not much. They didn't say much.
I do want to say before we move on to the next thing I want to ask you guys about that this series, Vanished, encompasses more than 10 stories, dozens of videos and audio. So definitely check it out on dispatch.com because we're only scratching the surface here in this conversation. But I want to circle back to something you said earlier, Danae, that Black people make up about 12% of Ohio's population, but almost half of the missing cases in the state. And that number's even higher for Black children. And one of the things you probed in this series is how cases get covered. So you sort of put Lacey Peterson versus Tamika Hudson. What can you tell us about? I mean, I think we all know Lacey Peterson, but who was Tamika Hudson?
Yeah, she was a Black woman who went missing in 2004, and her case was really not looked into at all. You know, police didn't take it up. The media didn't take it up. You know, it wasn't a national case like Lacey Peterson.
Yeah,
and we know there's kind of like this, they call it the missing white woman syndrome, where, you know, police and everybody rush to cover those kinds of events and media as well. And it goes back to police don't raise the alarm as much about a missing Black person. So we saw that locally with Sequoia Cooper. She's a missing Black transgender woman, and she went missing around the same time as Gabby Petito. And Gabby Petito was, you know, there were searches for her and national news coverage, and she was quickly found. Sequoia went missing in 2021 and still hasn't been found. Her family and media were not notified or wrapped into a search. There wasn't a press conference until 5 months after her disappearance.
You interviewed one of Sequoia's friends and who said something that kind of stopped me in my tracks, which was she used to think there was no perfect crime until Sequoia disappeared.
Yeah, because there's just not a trace of her. And part of that, she believes, is those first 48 hours are the most important. And those were the hours where police weren't concerned yet. You know, they didn't start taking up the case until much later on.
Max, was there any evidence of foul play in her case?
Yeah, so police, Danae, correct me if I'm wrong, about a month after she disappeared, they found her blood and shell casings in her car, which they found in Columbus.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that they did not tell the family that they found her car until several months later in February before they finally held that news conference. And even then, they didn't tell the family that they had found her blood and bullet casings.
Right. They just said evidence of foul play. But then, you know, later on, we were able to find what exactly was that evidence and share it with her family.
What did Columbus police have to say about that?
Well, they did not comment directly on the specific case. You know, again, when we had asked them, you know, about families who maybe learned of developments from the press, that's kind of where they threw out the, well, you know, usually there's one point person in a family that we communicate with, and it's, you know, we don't know if they're sharing stuff with everybody else in the family. You know, we can't be sure of that.
Yeah, all sides reached out to the department and got a pretty lengthy statement, and I'm going to read part of it that kind of echoes what Max just said. They said that we understand and empathize with the anguish of loved ones desperate for updates and answers. We do our sincere best to keep families informed of any developments, which requires a balancing act of being transparent while not compromising the investigation. And for multiple reasons, it's not practical to stay in contact with every member of the family. We understand family dynamics can be complex, and we can't know what updates are shared, which essentially mirrors what you guys got, too.
Yeah, that sounds very similar to the statement they sent us.
Max, I think the most disturbing article in this series, at least for me personally, was the one that you wrote about East Cleveland. 43 children have gone missing, which is way higher than other cities, far exceeds Columbus, Cincinnati, Cleveland per capita. What is happening in East Cleveland?
Yeah, well, I spent a day there with our photographer, Barbara Perenik. And the people who live in East Cleveland, the people of East Cleveland, very much believe that some wrongdoers or bad actors have zeroed in on the city. You know, human trafficking is a big concern to a lot of people there. They think that's a factor and whatnot. But I think it's also important to consider kind of what's going on in East Cleveland at large. You know, it's East Cleveland's police department was decimated by criminal indictments. Their mayor was recently indicted for corruption while in office. So the people who are tasked with sort of keeping the people of East Cleveland safe, you know, they're not there or they've gotten into trouble themselves.
Yeah. I was just going to add that, you know, most of these children are children of color. Mm-hmm. And so we know from the Black and Missing Foundation, which really makes its job to get these cases out and known about and to find these children, that, you know, the bad guys, the human traffickers, people who are abducting children and doing things like that, they know that Black children get less attention. And so even in this disenfranchised city, you know, they'll get even less attention than they would otherwise.
Yeah. Your investigation found 43 children, 24 girls, and 19 boys have vanished since late 2014. It works out to about 3 kids per 1,000 residents. And I do think that gets into something we're going to talk about later, which is vulnerability. Because when sex traffickers, when people looking to do no good are looking for victims, they are often looking for those who won't be missed.
Right. So, you know, that race comes into that.
Home life, socioeconomics.
Right. Family dynamics, socioeconomics, like you said. Yes.
I can't imagine the heartache of just the not knowing. Like when you talk to families who still have no idea where their loved one is, that's, I think I'd almost rather like if they're dead, I just want to know they are dead. Is that kind of what you heard?
Yeah, that's what we heard from a lot of these families. This is like a really different kind of anguish. Like, it's hard to explain because, you know, when you grieve someone, it's final. You say, good, you know, it's a goodbye. This is like they have a sliver of hope that their loved one might be out there alive and well somewhere. So they can't fully kind of grieve and say goodbye. So it's really, that's been something that's been really sad and interesting to see, as these families just, you know, have a different kind of grief.
Right. And I think, you know, the Cincinnati case we highlighted, Timothy Stanton, who went missing a decade ago, his son Austin Deller said, you know, a lot of times people will try to relate to him in terms of being like, oh, like, you know, I lost a parent too that passed away and whatnot. And his whole thing was, yeah, I know you did, but this is very different. I don't know what happened to my father. I don't know if he's alive or dead. I don't know, you know, where he is or yeah. So it's just a very difficult thing, that agonizing limbo that families find themselves in.
Yeah. Sequoia's friends, who you have on video, assume she's dead given the blood and the shell casings, but they still just don't know.
Right. And that's the hard thing, is like you can't kind of put things to rest because you don't know. And then there's that worry. Are they safe? Were they hurt? Are they still hurting? That really plagues these families.
Coming up, a criminology researcher who works with law enforcement for on best practices for finding these missing persons. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
What happens in Washington? The NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. When a person goes missing, we assume the police do everything within their power to find them. And that may be the case, but the important word there is within their power. What happens if a department doesn't have officers dedicated to missing persons? What if they've had little to no training? What if they're overworked and understaffed and simply lack the resources to investigate someone who could have potentially walked away on their own? These are the questions University of Louisiana professor Michelle Genis tries to answer. She researches missing persons and works with law enforcement to develop best practices. And she joins us now. Michelle, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
Still with us this hour are Columbus Dispatch reporters Max Philby and Danae King. The duo spent 8 months investigating missing persons in Ohio for a series with the Columbus Dispatch called Vanished. Michelle, in Vanished, you are quoted as saying, "Police don't know what to do when they get a missing persons case. It's a free-for-all." Can you explain what you mean by that?
We have no universal protocols for adult missing persons cases, so there's really no standard of practice. So each individual agency is working off of their best understanding of what to do. And bigger agencies may they have more resources and they may have already handled a missing persons case. Smaller agencies may not have much experience with that at all. And so they probably have limited resources and limited guidance, actually. You know, I teach a missing persons class to undergraduates, and it took me about 3 months of work to find a sort of best practices for adults. And that it shouldn't be that hard.
Max, you interviewed Attorney General Dave Yost, and he echoed a little bit of what Michelle just said about a lack of resources, right?
Yeah, he said virtually every police department in the state of Ohio is understaffed. And like Michelle said, some of the larger departments may have dedicated detectives. Many of the smaller ones do not. So it is sort of a balancing act at figuring out who needs the training, when do you need the training, and, you know, how do you adequately conduct these investigations with the resources you do have?
Yeah, it's a balancing act. If you have a armed robbery, a burglary, and you have an adult who is missing, how do you figure which one gets priority? I do want to talk a little bit about large police departments like Columbus. So you looked at the data and the caseload of the 8 detectives for missing persons ranges from 400 to 867 missing persons reports for each officer per year. Michelle, that sounds overwhelming in terms of caseload.
That's outrageous. And I would bet that the vast majority of those cases are runaway youth, which, don't get me wrong, they need a lot of help and they are very at risk, but they run repetitively. They usually come home really quickly. It's really taxing on law enforcement. So I would bet a lot of that are those kiddos who need a certain kind of intervention, and a smaller portion of our adults who go missing, who you can not have a lot of leads or ability to investigate those well.
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction, Danae. You said that age 10 is when Columbus declares a child no longer high risk, and that makes a huge difference in the kind of response that they give.
Yeah, so if a child is high risk, that's sent out to media, that's posted on their social media sites, the National Center for Exploited and Missing Children would be notified. You know, there's all kinds of notifications that go out if they are high risk, but once they hit, you know, that age where it's no longer high risk and there's not other factors involved, people might not even know that child is missing or to look for them. You know, it's really society isn't able to help at all at that point.
And if they're a runaway, Michelle, they don't get an Amber Alert.
They do not. And in addition, that the 10-year-old age limit really struck me, because I have next to me my big book from the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children that says they should be high risk until 13, period.
Yeah, so it's not standard. In your reporting, Max and Danae, you found that in Akron and Toledo, it is 13. In Cleveland and Dayton, it's 14. Cincinnati does not appear to set an age. Michelle, it really just depends on whatever the local department has decided.
Exactly. And same thing with adult missing persons cases. When there's no standard, we just kind of do whatever we want. And some people are going to do awesome, and some people are going to do not so well.
Danae, can you tell us about Melanie Elkins?
Yeah, so Melanie is a 13-year-old who was from Akron, and she had struggles. You know, her mom died when she was young, and so she lived with her father, and a friend of his had raped her in their home several times before she went missing, and her grandmother, who did not live with her, was trying to get custody of her and help her. She also alleged that her dad had been violent toward her, and Children's Services and the police had been out. You know, there were cases in court about her custody and her safety, and she ran away 3 times, and she was labeled as a runaway by police. And they did look for her a little bit, but ultimately she was found dead in Akron last year.
It's so incredibly sad. And who knows, had she gotten a little more attention, whether they would have found her. You can't run the story again and do things differently. But Michelle, I think that's so hard to understand. Like, clearly she was running because of problems, but that doesn't mean she wasn't in danger.
The vast majority of our kiddos who run from caregivers are running from abuse, neglect, and trauma. But there's this big belief system in our society that kids who run away are just incorrigible. They don't want to listen to mom and dad. They aren't in danger. So we don't allocate a lot of resources for them. But in fact, 1 in 6 are at risk for exploitation in the form of human trafficking. Within the first 24 hours, typically, of their disappearance, they are solicited. So the world is incredibly dangerous for our runaway kiddos. But we as a society don't seem to be picking up on that.
Yeah, I always say sex traffickers rarely kidnap kids from Target. They lure them away on the internet. You're nodding, Michelle.
Absolutely. We're scared of I talk to my students, you know, what does a sex offender look like? And they're like, well, he definitely has a rape van, right?
The white van, yeah.
Exactly. And so we spend all our time worrying about this imaginary danger when really it's the person trying to befriend you, is overly nice, doesn't take no for an answer, that kind of thing.
Max, you guys found that 54% of Ohio children who went missing in 2023 were labeled runaways, and nationwide they account for 74% of children reported to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So a lot of these children who are running away don't get that high-risk designation.
Right. And to your point, that means if the overwhelming majority of kids labeled runaways or missing kids are labeled runaways, the overwhelming majority aren't going to be eligible for, say, an Amber Alert or something called an Endangered Missing Child Alert, which is an alert that has a lower threshold that does not exclude runaways, but it has to include a child who is considered at serious risk of injury or death. So the overwhelming majority of kids who go missing, you're likely never going to get that flashing alert on your phone or on a billboard.
Melanie Elkins didn't get that lower designation either, correct?
Right, she didn't get either.
Danae, Attorney General Dave Yost told you guys that people need to alter their mindset that a runaway faces less danger than a child who is missing.
Yeah, and that's what we've found from experts like Michelle and the National Center for Exploited and Missing Children. You know, this kids are in danger if they're out there on their own. You know, they're subject to all sorts of dangers because they shouldn't be out alone, you know. They can't fend for themselves. So, yeah, no matter why they went missing, we've been told they're still definitely in danger.
All sides also reached out to the Columbus police for comment, and I want to read part of what they said. And they said, new information sometimes triggers a high-risk designation, and it frequently comes from their preliminary investigations. Quote, if there are any indications of a person being trafficked or taken against their will, re-leverage partnerships with U.S. Marshals and Human Trafficking Task Force. And we maintain regular communication and collaboration based on the evidence. Michelle, does that include ever looking at a teen's, say, online history to kind of figure out if somebody has lured them away?
Absolutely, yes. And I think one thing that we often miss are our boys playing video games. And that is a big way that predators can have access to those kiddos by pretending to be their friend. And you can have relationships for months and mom and dad may never know.
Yeah, especially if they're talking on Discord, which is popular for gaming. Absolutely. And if you don't know what Discord is, you should probably find out if you have teenage kids. You know, when it comes to missing adults, I feel like things get even more complicated. Michelle, getting that high-risk designation feels like a pretty high bar.
Absolutely. A lot of our adult missing persons cases are quiet in the way that I describe it. They don't have bloody crime scenes. You may not know there is a crime scene. So oftentimes, and because we are allowed to disappear if we want to, law enforcement's hands can be tied and it can be very difficult for them to even identify what risk level to put that person at. I'm begging for some sort of protocol because I know our law enforcement want to do good things. They're not trying to be incompetent. They just need help, I think.
How do they balance people who are trying to disappear, say, because of abuse or domestic violence? Like, you may have a very good reason to not want to be found.
It's really hard to disappear. As we've seen, there have been a couple of high-profile cases recently of people trying to, like, pseudocide, as we call it, like, fake their deaths or disappearances. In today's world, it is really, really, really difficult to do. And oftentimes, it's very easy to see a paper trail with digital evidence. So you can pretty much kick out that option pretty early on in the game if you have access to their digital evidence in that way. But that is a factor that complicates us as well. We have free will.
We do have free will, but that can be a double-edged sword. Danae, you guys brought up a case of a woman whose husband went missing during her birthday party in Easton, and the police were like, maybe he just wanted to leave you.
Right. Brittany Davis is her name, and her husband, Tyler Davis, went missing 5 years ago in the early morning hours of a Sunday morning. And, you know, she waited 6 hours since she'd last heard from him and then called police, and they largely kind of wrote her off. She felt like she was just being a bother and a burden. And they even told her, you know, do you know how many missing people we have? How many older adults, how many children are missing? You know, your 29-year-old husband might have just walked away.
And in the 5 years that he's been missing, there's been no trace of him.
That's correct.
Michelle, you said that's hard to do, just vanish without a trace completely. I think he didn't leave in a car. There's no...
He was on foot at Easton. His phone stopped, you know, like they weren't able to reach him on his phone at all or find his phone.
Hasn't used his credit cards.
Right.
Didn't take out a whole lot of cash before he disappeared. I don't know.
Signs that would suggest high risk, but in honesty, that I've heard this so many times, especially when it comes to men who go missing. There tends to be a push that they can take care of themselves. They must just want to leave. They're not in danger. Let's just let this go. No crime happened.
Max, that's got to be hard to be like, oh, if you disappeared, they might just think, hey, maybe you just wanted to leave.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, and that's kind of what we've heard from a lot of people, though, you know, is that they always thought that if something like this did happen, like you said, Anna, that police would be there with the search dogs and whatnot. You know, they'd go hunting in the woods. But the reality is that is very often, especially when it comes to adults, not the case.
You would think this case, though, good-looking young husband, adorable little family, small children, you would think that has all the makings of like a big media splash.
Yeah, but it didn't take, you know, it wasn't really in the media because police didn't notify the media for weeks after he went missing. And now it's a cold case, so.
Michelle, that's a difficult question. How, like some cases, like Lacey Peterson, like Gabby Petito, we just hear about. We hear so much about, and other cases just never make the news.
That's what I see in my research is about half don't make the news at all. And there's some growing research, not mine, but others, that looks at that police may be the gatekeepers for assigning missingness. So I really wanted to mention that. You know, they've talked to newspaper outlets and they've said, we will not cover a case unless the police say that this person is missing because somebody could just be trying to stalk their loved one. The police may have much more power in this and they may be the gatekeepers. So it can't even get to the news if the police don't say, yes, this is a missing persons case. And there is no 24-hour rule. That's a myth. A lot of people think you have to wait 24 hours. You don't at all. You don't even have to wait 15 minutes. You can call right away.
Well, that's good to know. Coming up, the amateur investigators who have dedicated their lives to solving these cold cases. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
What happens in Washington? The NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're spending this hour with the people who have vanished in Ohio, the people who go missing, whether by choice or by violence. Still with us are Columbus Dispatch reporters Max Philby and Danae King. Their 8-month investigation into Ohio's missing persons is now live at dispatch.com. Still with us also is University of Louisiana Criminal Justice Professor Michelle Genus. Michelle, law enforcement isn't the only person searching for the people who vanished. Oftentimes, there are amateur sleuths who have gotten into this game, and sometimes they're the ones who solve these incredibly cold cases.
All of missing persons started with grassroots, right? It was the Johnny Goshes and the Adam Walsh's parents that basically got NCMEC started. So we have a long tradition of sort of handling it ourselves. And there are so many organizations that were started usually by the families of the missing, the Polly Class Foundation, the Charlie Project, the DNA Doe. And so they have a huge ability to solve these cases. Grateful Doe is probably the big one that stood out, mostly harmless. They got a documentary. I could go on and on. We're solving cases, guys.
Danae, can you tell us about Megan Good and the Charlie Project? Because it's built by an Ohio native.
Yeah, Megan Good, she's been spending the last 20 years of her life just really dedicated to this online database that she created. She took it over from someone else who, you know, had kind of wanted to pass it off, and then it got hacked, so she created it from the ground up. And the Charlie Project, she is incredible. And so she really brings all these clues and, you know, information about missing people and puts it in one place. Oftentimes she has like photos of tattoos and things that police don't even have, you know, identifying things. And she puts it in one place. And people who are trying to solve these cases online use the Charlie Project.
It has more than 16,000 missing people in its database. And has it ever led to a case being solved?
Yeah, it's led to multiple cases being solved. So she told me a few different cases that were solved that she's heard back from people who have said, you know, I used what you had on your website and, you know, maybe they put it on Reddit or they crowdsourced it with other people or they looked into other national databases and found clues and solved the case.
Yeah. And it's not just people in the U.S. You had one in your article that I was like, oh, my goodness. So in 2014, a woman in Ireland matched a missing Texas man's description from the Charlie Project to an unidentified body in Arizona. Michelle, that is wild.
Armchair detectives are getting it done, and they take it very seriously. I know they get a bad, they have some negative connotations, but the people who are doing this kind of work take it very seriously. They fact checked. It's an organization of people working together. Before they submit anything to law enforcement, they go through all of the hoops to make sure it's legitimate.
Max, sometimes it's a simple clerical error that keeps a case cold for decades. Can you tell us about Linda Pagano, a teenager who went missing in Akron 50 years ago?
Today, I think you know more about that one than I do.
Yeah, so she got in a fight with her stepdad and walked off. She was going to go home and or to her mom's house and never was seen again. So her case went unsolved for nearly 50 years, and a college student who was doing her own genealogy research in Cleveland got interested in some cemetery records that were the bones of a young woman that had never been matched to any body or, you know, remains or, you know, any name. And so she got interested and started crowdsourcing and eventually was connected online with a sketch artist who made a sketch of Linda. And it wasn't in national databases, her DNA, because of a clerical error, like you mentioned. And just the attention on the case from this college student was able to fix that clerical error and make the match.
And that's it wild to me. So she was doing her own genealogy research. She wasn't even like one of these people trying to solve cold cases. And she saw these unidentified bones listed as being buried in the Rocky River. The bones were found along Rocky River in a Cleveland suburb. And the bones were found in February of 1975. So not that long after Linda went missing.
Right. It was months after she went missing that they were found. But the connection, it was different jurisdictions. You know, it wasn't in this federal database. And the connection was never made.
There's another big case from here in Ohio. Back in 2006, an OSU medical student named Brian Davis disappeared from a bar and was never seen again. And that resulted in a woman named Lori Davis dedicating her life to figuring out what happened to Brian.
Yeah, so Lori's is a really interesting case. She was just watching the news one night and saw Brian Schaefer's case come up on TV. And she got online and started Googling it and realized that the website was kind of having some issues. Like, people were upset that the family wasn't doing the website the way they wanted. And so she was a web designer and she was just like, I can help. And 18 years later, she's still helping missing people.
You know, Max, what struck me about Brian Davis, and Michelle, this could be for you as well, he was a good-looking guy. He was a medical student. I think his mother had recently passed away, so maybe he was dealing with some pain and sadness, but he walked into a bar off campus and there's no video, no record of him ever walking out.
Right. It's a very, very sort of infamous local case. You know, I think police had told us, Danae, correct me if I'm wrong, they still get tips to this day on and off about that case. He's never been found. His case remains open and cold.
I want to talk about some of the databases that officers can use, federal databases, law enforcement. So there, Michelle, can you tell us about the FBI's National Crime Information Center and NAMIS?
Absolutely. So NCIC is kind of where we start to understand the total rates of missingness and our total amount of active missing persons cases at the end of each year, which is about 86,000. However, that's about it. It's real basic. So we have to turn to NamUs to get any sort of sampling frame of the amount of missing persons cases. NamUs was started by Todd Matthews, who was just a regular old human out there wanting to serve and solve a missing persons case. And he created NamUs, and then he created the DOE Network, one of the founders. So basically, in 2009, it became publicly available for its civilians to use and for the law enforcement to have access to. Anybody can go and search, and it's the closest we have to our full understanding of who goes missing and where and how.
According to its own data, they have helped solve more than 46,000 disappearances since its creation in 2007. And Michelle, in 2022, a federal law would require law enforcement officers to enter missing children into it, but it's not going exactly the way anyone hoped.
And it's not required for adults. So unfortunately, you get very limited information. Each agency decides when they want to post that information. It could be incomplete or full records. For a period of time, it wasn't run by the DOJ, so there was a lot of miscommunication about how and when. So it's the best we have, but it is very flawed. It is not the full scope of missing persons cases, especially indigenous missing persons are likely very low level documented on NamUs.
Max Denae, how often does Ohio put names into these systems?
Yeah, well, so we reviewed several hundreds of cases from the Ohio Attorney General's website, which, try to follow me here, pulls cases from the National Crime Information Center. And so we decided to cross-reference these with NamUs. And we found that of the cases where people had been missing at least a year, 344 Ohioans were not entered into NamUs. And that is sort of the idea behind NamUs, right? It's sort of for these long-term missing cases where police have perhaps run down every lead and they've gone cold. So 344 Ohioans missing a year or more, not in NamUs.
And the percentage was pretty high for missing kids.
Yeah, it was 89% were not in NamUs who were still missing in Ohio after 1 year. And, just to iterate, like, the importance of these databases is that, a child could end up across state lines. They could end up across jurisdictional lines, even within the same state. If their information isn't in here, they may never be found because there's no way for these departments to communicate with one another other than these databases.
Michelle, do you think best practice, like if you could wave a law, a magic wand and require would be to mandate that full information, full reporting goes into these databases?
Step one, absolutely yes. And we'll never have accountability unless we have best practices.
So, what does best practices look like when it comes to training? Because according to Max and Danae's reporting, in Ohio, about 14 hours of the 740-hour basic training is dedicated to both missing persons and human trafficking. Is that enough time?
That's probably not enough time. And there's a lot to take into account with the family dynamics and interviewing all of these people and the emotional trauma and ambiguous loss and all of that that the average person doesn't know about. So if we need trauma-informed training, probably for all of step one for our law enforcement. That would help missing persons and a lot of others as well. I also think we need to combat our runaway issue. We need some runaway specialists working with law enforcement so that they have a better way, a better understanding of how to handle that. More resources can go to the runaway specialist so our law enforcement can be spending our time on our missing adults.
Max Denae, you found that officers receive 40 hours of training here in Ohio, three times as much training on how to operate their radar guns to catching speeding motorists. And I thought that was a really poignant analogy. So they get more training on the radar gun than on missing persons.
Right. So they're not trained as much to find these people. They don't know the right questions to ask of parents and loved ones. And, even the police admitted sometimes, a patrol officer will go out to take a report and they won't get enough information back to determine whether that case is, you know, should be raised and be high risk.
That training requirement too on the radar guns, it's set to be removed. But I think one of the things, you know, we discussed with the Attorney General about and whatnot is that's something that probably almost every officer gets some training in the real world every day. Missing persons, not so much. So it might make more sense to require more missing persons training later on in an officer's career, perhaps, especially in bigger cities, he said.
Especially as they move, say, from traffic cop to detective, if they're moving up in the career ladder. He did also mention something that I want to ask all of you about. Money. That more training without funding is essentially an unfunded mandate.
Yeah, so he was really careful about that because there's, you know, a lack of resources in these departments already, and putting more on them, you know, he cautioned about putting more work on these departments. So,
yeah, and you know, I get what he was saying there. He was very careful in saying that perhaps there does need to be a new law requiring, you know, entry into NamUs and whatnot. But he was very careful to say that we don't want to create another burden for police. We want them to solve these cases.
Yeah, Michelle, I mean, that's the story of any organization, whether it's public or private, right? Not enough money for all the things you'd like to do.
The squeaky wheel gets greased.
Yeah. And it's hard with missing people, particularly, I think, because it is so murky, because you do, and maybe that's my own personal bias, you have this idea that maybe they really just wanted to vanish.
I think we'd like that as an easy answer. And I think with missingness is this ambiguity where in which they may not be victims and there may not be offenders. And so that ambiguity, I think, gives us the freedom to say, oh, well, we're not going to pay attention to this one, or we're not going to allocate resources to this one because we have this out. They may not even be victims.
Yeah, I think, at least that's what you tell yourself when you're really out of time and out of money and you've got 1,000 other cases on your desk.
Exactly that.
Max, Danae, you guys spent 8 months with these stories, and is there any, they're all haunting in very different ways, and I think we all attach and latch on to one depending on our own personal histories. Is there one that, like, has really stuck with either of you?
I mean, it's hard to pick just one because they're all, like you said, so haunting. You know, when I think about this, what I think about the most is just these families and their desperation to find their loved one. Max?
Yeah, I think for me, like you said, Danae, they're all, you know, you really feel for all these families. One that really stuck with me was the disappearance of Danny Fout. Spent some time with his mom and his sisters. You know, he disappeared kind of in the throes of addiction, and they really felt like police dropped the ball in his case simply because he was suffering from addiction. You know, I think you mentioned this earlier, Anna, but anybody who suffers from mental health issues or addiction, they are predisposed to going missing. And there's a lot of research that suggests that's the case, too.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the cases that really gets to me that we haven't discussed is the one of DeJuan Lewis Taylor. He was a 15-year-old kid, and he had some trouble at school and with his family, and he was staying at Mary Havian's now. You know, it doesn't do adolescent care anymore, but he was in adolescent residential care at Mary Haven and ran away. He climbed the fence and ran away the night after he'd been attacked by another resident. And, you know, they told his mom, we don't have time to look for him. You know, this isn't our job. We don't have time to go looking for runaway kids. And 2 weeks later, he ended up shot and killed. That sticks with me.
Yeah, I think it would stick. Especially being like, well, we don't have time to go find him. He ran out. He disappeared on our watch, but it's not our problem.
And you expect him to be safe in this residential facility where he's
you
getting counseling.
You put him there to be safe.
Right, for counseling.
Yeah, I don't know. Michelle, we have just under a minute left, but what, I guess, if there's one thing you would want people to take away from this, what would it be?
I would hope that we start to pay attention even before we're personally affected, because the psychological consequences for the families of the missing are severe, and we often don't think of that until it becomes us. So I hope more people are interested in this topic, even if they aren't personally affected, because that's what it's going to take.
And if you want to be more interested in this topic, you can go to dispatch.com. Their series, Vanished, is I mean, 10 articles, 8 months of research, definitely worth a read. I want to say thanks to Columbus Dispatch reporter Max Philby. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And Danae King. Thank you so much for all your work on this.
Thanks so much, Anna.
And finally, thank you to University of Louisiana Criminal Justice Professor Michelle Genis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.